Our last speaker is he and his partner. Adam Reddick is an architectural design specialist at Stantec in San Francisco office, and his partner Matt Ginberg is also going to have part of this presentation. But his responsibilities include working on a firm-wide BIM strategies as well as various design documents and coordinating tasks. He collaborated with the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories in a research project for energy modeling purposes and consulting. So at this time, I'm going to introduce Adam.
Good morning, everyone. I hope you're going to hear me. I'm going to use this one. So I am an architectural design specialist at Stantec, and I'm presenting here with Coburg.
My name is Matt Grunberg, and I'm a mechanical engineer and energy modeler. And we're here today to talk to you about how the design team and energy modelers can share information to build better buildings. And we wanted to describe a tool that we started to implement on some of our major projects. So here are our learning objectives. And we'd like to acknowledge some people for their help on this project. Here's our outline for this talk.
So we would like to start with talking about a very important subject, which is setting targets, setting energy goals, because these will ultimately affect the outcome of our projects. We have talked about this before at previous sessions, and we heard presentations about this, but it is very important in our case too, and very much relevant to our presentation.
Yeah, so there's different types of goals that we can set for our projects, starting from lean, going all the way up to zero net energy. I hope that you've heard Paul or Shanti talk about the NREL RSF project. That project wouldn't be able to be complete without setting really firm energy targets right from the get-go. And this is also possible for other projects. They might not be net zero goals, but even healthcare projects like the Cleveland Clinic and UCSF have energy targets that we must meet.
These are just some of our projects. Our San Francisco office has designed many healthcare facilities, and as you probably know, they have inherent constraints that will lead to different targets that you have to set. Nevertheless, the setting of the targets is very important.
Yep. And so in order to reach these targets, we need to have a feedback mechanism that allows us to see if we're heading in the right direction. And for energy targets, that tool is energy modeling. We need energy modeling to tell us if we're heading in, we're reaching our energy targets in our design.
In fact, this is one of the biggest reasons why we do energy modeling, to have a numerified feedback to see if we are on target and if we are meeting our goals.
The other part is we need to have a plan. Once we set a target and we know what tools we're going to use, we need to plan out how we're going to get there.
A couple of years ago, when Matt and I started working on a project, we found that there are two major aspects of the plan, of how you plan out the interaction between the design team and the energy modeler. One is obviously a technical component of it, how you use programs and how you exchange data. But the other one, which is a very important component, is communication. And we found that the communication component has been largely not discussed in the industry. So we started working on this tool that we've been using, and Matt mentioned that it's been currently used on two of our projects that helped us better understand what the flow of communication is going to be. But more importantly, it keeps everything at a high level where it's understandable to all participants.
Yeah, so this allows for the design team and the energy modelers to understand what's actually going into their energy model. And so what we did was we broke apart the categories of the types of exchange information that happen between the design team and energy modelers. And we've identified 12 categories seen here. They include climate, and the HVAC system, the geometry of the building, the occupants of the building. This is all that goes into the energy model.
These are the typical information categories that we found that are commonly exchanged between the design team and the energy modeler.
Some of which is the energy modelers giving suggestions to the design team, some guidance for them before they design, and some of it is the design team telling the energy modeler, this is the design that we need to analyze. And so there's two different ways to do this analysis. There's an option of focusing on one specific category and identifying what direction you want to take that specific category. So for example, we can look at fenestration and really dive into what is the best way to design that specific part of a building, largely ignoring the rest of the building. And this is a really helpful design tool. It's a tool that architects use. It's a tool that mechanical engineers use to drive design. But the other side of it is this holistic analysis. This is where we take all 12 of those categories and incorporate it into one model to really understand the performance of the building.
In fact, this is a lesson that is not absolutely clear to all design team participants. Sometimes they focus on certain aspects, certain categories of information, thinking that if they meet their goals in that particular area, they're good. Where only holistic analysis, only when you incorporate everything into your thinking, can tell you if in that particular project that is actually going to be relevant or not. You may find that another category is a much more important, much higher priority category that is going to drive your energy consumption.
Right. So looking at the RSF, I think David Okada is going to go over the actual mechanical system tomorrow at around this time. But this is what the energy model looked like for the RSF building, and it is complex because it needs to incorporate all of the all of those categories into one model, and there isn't just a piece of software that that performs an energy model. It is a combination of things. So here we have different pieces of software interacting with each other, and then that information being extracted, and some hand calculations that are done, and all of that gets put together into Excel results. This is sort of a complicated project, but this is a typical way that you would approach energy modeling, not through a specific piece of software, but through trying to understand the building as a whole.
So this is something also that is not absolutely clear to design teams, obviously, what is happening in the background and how complex energy modeling, the energy modeling part itself can get.
Yeah, and the reason why we do this is because it answers three questions. It tells us how much energy we're using, if you have the right inputs, and you design your energy model in a really good way, you can actually tell within a range what your energy use is going to be, and we can see that on the RSF project. We also can identify what's important to focus on. And when looking at those 12 categories, when you look at them individually, you don't know if that's the right thing to focus on. When you look at them together, you can focus on them individually. And obviously, the third one is, are we meeting our goals? This basically completes the feedback in trying to reach our energy targets.
So back to our tool, this is basically how it works. We have an information pad for each category that we mentioned before. This is representing the continuation of the development of information in that particular category. This symbolizes the fact that the information is gradually but constantly changing through the design process.
So we've identified this as through a timeline. So here we have an example of a pre-schematic design, and we're taking it all the way to 100% pre-schematic design, and then we add coordination events.
Right. So these are the events where the energy modelers and the design team members meet and exchange information. These are significant events in terms of how this workflow is happening, how information is exchanged between the two parties.
For this example, we have three coordination events in this pre-schematic phase. They include site analysis, program fitting, and then massing. That's the third one over there.
Once we see these events clearly, we can see also that different events will discuss different types of information. So some of it will be discussed earlier, some of it will be discussed later. These are what we call the station markers, where actual information exchange is happening on the timeline.
And we can identify what event is responsible for gathering what pieces of information.
If we look at it closer, these station markers, you can see that we have a couple of important features of these station markers. Starting with the top, there's a numeric value, which is symbolizing our confidence in this piece of information. We started to call it earlier as the confidence level. It essentially means that certain types of information are more defined.
That's right.
Certain ones are less defined. And as we gradually progress in our development, these pieces of information gain more confidence. So this vector is growing. Then we also saw that there is a very similar concept in building information modeling, which is level of details. And we realized that for the sake of easier exchange or easier coordination between the disciplines, it is very applicable to our case. So we started to incorporate it in our scenario, a version of this level of detail.
Yeah, so that's where we get this 100 and 175. That is the level of detail of this piece of information. In this case, it's fenestration. And you can see that as the project progresses, it increases.
What's very important about this piece of information is that if you think about it, it's not quite obvious to all participants what the definition, what the certainty of that information is. So if we use this numerifier, we instantly bring everybody to the same level of understanding, and they're on the same page of what we are actually talking about, what that represents.
And so here we can take a look at a specific piece of information. This is just an example. Let's call this window to wall ratio. And so we can see that throughout the course of a project, the value for window to wall ratio changes because the design changes, gets updated. But it's not just the changing value. There's more to it than that. What happens is that we get more confident in that value. We zero in on exactly what the window to wall ratio will be when constructed. And so in the beginning, you have large error bars, and at the end, you have very small error bars. And that's what we're trying to represent with level of detail.
Going back, we also see that there is some definition under the station markers. Again, remember that the categories represent a group of information. And in these cases, with the station markers, we're specifying what actual information we're exchanging at that point. So that gives us more details.
So here we have, for example, in geometry, we have a site boundary. And then once we figure out the site boundary, we can move on to footprint.
It is gaining more clarity, and of course the LOD is rising.
Yeah.
So, as we go along too.
And then the other piece is who's responsible for this piece of information, and that's what we're identifying with the E's and the AE. That is setting the responsibility on either the energy modeler to provide that information, the architect to provide that information, or some combination. Lastly, we bring all of this information together into an energy model, and so we have that represented here in this box. This is a great way to figure out what were the inputs and where they came from to go into the model. So, for example, climate was assessed during site analysis early on, and then occupancy was talked about here in program fitting. And then the geometry had been updated all along, but what's going into the energy model comes from this massing exercise. So you can really clearly see what is actually incorporated into each energy model and how much level of detail each piece of information has.
You can also see that in the energy modeling box, there are certain categories which I highlighted. These are categories that are redefined or fine-tuned through the energy modeling exercise itself. So all of the categories serve as input values to the energy modeling, but some of these categories are actually redefined through the iterative process of the energy modeling itself.
Yeah, and so because this example is a pre-schematic design, we see a lot of things in flux in the energy model because the design is not really tied down yet. But we've extrapolated this not only for the pre-schematic design, but here we see it for the pre-schematic and schematic design. And here the design development and construction documents phase, and you can see that during design development we might have two energy modeling exercises, and in the construction documents phase we might have a final energy model where nothing is in flux because the design is complete, and then we might have a separate lead model to assess how many lead points we get. And then we further extrapolated this out to the construction and M&B phases of a project. So this can be used throughout the course of a project up until its end. So for conclusion?
We see this tool as a kind of a language of information exchange that has very high-level impact on all disciplines that are involved in the process itself. It creates a common level of understanding. It is understandable for all participants because of the high level of representation. So we found this very useful because suddenly we can talk about the same things without diving into too many technical details.
And so when you're setting your energy targets, you can bring everyone together as the stakeholders in reaching those energy targets. And we're talking about the architect, the mechanical engineer, the electrical engineer, the civil engineer, and also the owner. And this tool allows you not just to set those targets and say we should reach them, but to track how we are reaching those targets.
And with that, we would like to thank you for your time and listening to us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We do have time for a couple of questions if there are questions from the audience who come to the microphone.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. My name is Jinjin from Con Edison in New York City. The question is for the last speakers. And I'm very curious in setting your goals and looking at and working with all the stakeholders, how do you deal with the issue of plug load? Because it's such a hard variable to control. It's so dependent on the end user. And also, it's kind of a wild card, right? You could either have everyone who's responsible and only plug in the computers, or you can have people who are plugging heaters, water heater, little local heater. So how do you control that in your design phase, and how do you allocate for that in that variance?
I'm really glad you asked that, because what happens when a building gets designed is that the architects focus on their parts, and the mechanical engineer focus on their parts, and then the energy modelers are responsible for gathering all that information and telling them what they should do with their design. And there is this issue of plug loads, and plug loads can be like up to 50% of a building's energy use. It's not really clear to anyone that needs to be addressed through a specific means. When you lay out all of the categories that are going to be affecting your energy use, it becomes really clear what's going into the model, how much effect it has on the model, and who's responsible for driving this information. So in the case of plug loads, this is how you get the owners engaged in your project. You not only tell them, please reduce plug loads, but you say, this is what's affecting the model. we can see that we need information from you. So you need to take maybe account of what your current plug loads are, what plug loads you're expecting, and then maybe as the as a way to reach our energy targets, the owner has a responsibility to drive down the plug loads. And of course, as designers who have worked on these types of projects, we can help them along in that way. We can give them some criteria to lead them in the right direction in terms of what to purchase and how to operate their building.
Thank you.
Question. My name is Chris Martin. I'm with Phase Change Energy, and I noticed you talked about the different softwares that you guys may use. Energy Plus, this is for the last group, Energy Plus for eQuest seems to be a little light compared to all the work that you're doing, and then to use eQuest just seemed, just any comments on the software? I think that was on the presentation.
Okay, so is this about the NREL model? There's a couple parts to it. There were parts to our building that really didn't have the modules in Energy Plus at the time. So, for example, our labyrinth calculation, the RSF has a large labyrinth underneath. That was a very unique case, and so we have a genius in-house who developed a spreadsheet model of how the labyrinth would function. And so that needed to be incorporated into our energy model. And then the other parts of the building were simpler, and so it didn't make sense to really go into the energy plus route because, frankly, of the amount of time and effort it would take to run such a complex simulation. What we try to do with our energy model that consisted of many different parts is try to isolate the easier parts and do them in the easier software. And eQuest is also a tested software that has been validated over many years of use. So it was one that we can rely on because we needed to make sure that our building actually hit the energy targets. So I think it was a good choice to use that along with IES and Radiance and others.
Any other questions?
Hi, my name is David O'Connor. I'm with AIRP in Seattle. My question is, what are there any formats that your workflow, graphics, and materials are available so that other folks could use that and help use that as a communication tool?
Yes. We developed this workflow first in a graphic design software, and then we realized that once we started to move into the implementation phase and started to use it on projects that's just not going to work. It's really hard to customize when it's sitting in a tool like Adobe Illustrator or something like that. So we developed a version which is in Excel, and it's very easy to customize. Every project will need a customized version of the workflow, of course, and it's available free, and you can just send us an email, and we're glad to send it to you.
Thank you. Panel. Presenters, thank you very much for your time and the information. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.